Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Waging Peace, One Soldier's Story of Putting Love First, by Diana Oestreich. Foreword by Danielle Strickland. Narrated by Sarah Wellborn. A World to Gain. Groping, hoping, waiting. For what? A world to gain. Dreams kicked asunder. Why not go under? There's a world to gain. But suppose I don't want it. Why take it? To remake it. Langston Hughes, The Panther and the Lash. Foreword. Over the last few years, after reading headline after headline about the violence and pain around the world, I started to feel overcome by fear and hopelessness. I want to be a person of hope, the kind of hope that has arms and legs and flesh and blood, but my fears started to tell me a story of how to respond to all that pain. I found myself squeezed into a worldly idea of how we can restrain the violence we see from ISIS and other groups that are causing so much pain and havoc. I had been squeezed into believing the best scenario would be for the bombs to fall on the right people. Now, think about that for a second. That's a hopeless prayer. That's a despairing prayer. At best, that's a worldly prayer. That's the solution the world has to offer. Violence is a despairing cultural value. But we are people of hope. Now is the time when we need to pray transformational prayers. We need hope. We need to hear stories that lead us into wide open spaces of transformational love. This book is one of those stories that shine a light on hope. Diana walked into war a soldier and walked out a peacemaker. God disarmed her and asked her to pick up the most powerful weapon on the planet, self-sacrificing love. Answering God's call to love those she's been told to see as enemies freed her to be a citizen of the kingdom of God first and a citizen of her country second. Loving our enemies is a revolutionary answer to the deep despair in our world. It's not just some kind of idealistic optimism. It's an invitation to become, not just to believe in, the most beautiful world possible. We become messengers of hope in a despairing world when we choose to confront violence armed with a relentless love instead of hate. Diana is showing us the way by living out the answers to these questions. What if you didn't have to choose between your country and the call to love? What if there was room at the table to be both a peacemaker and a patriot? How would we be different if we laid down our lives for our enemies as fiercely as we did for our friends? I believe the time is now to become the antidote to the despair around us. Diana is a trustworthy guide to lead us into transforming the world around us with love. Dare to walk straight into war alongside her, because you won't be the same person afterward. Danielle Strickland, co-founder of Infinitum, Amplify Peace, Brave Global, and Women Speakers Collective, and author of Better Together. Prologue. If you slow down or stop the convoy to avoid running over a child, you will be responsible for your fellow soldiers getting attacked. I hope you understand your duty. The commander's words stung me. I was receiving the mandatory safety briefing for the next day's 4 a.m. convoy into an active war zone in Iraq. The combination of the heat of the tent and the lateness of the hour had been pushing my eyelids closed, but now he had my full attention. Safety briefings followed the same script. We trained as we fought, so even in war, it was routine, never a surprise, until now. His words made the sleepy room of soldiers buzz as if someone had poked a beehive with a stick. The commander went on to describe a tactic the enemy used to interrupt the American invasion of Iraq. They would push Iraqi children in front of military convoys. When the trucks slowed or stopped to avoid hitting the children, the enemy would attack the last trucks in the convoy. Being at the end of the convoy made the soldiers sitting ducks. They couldn't move forward to get away, and with no other trucks behind them, they were easily ambushed. The commander barked over the voices of 100 soldiers in the tent. "I repeat, if you slow the convoy to avoid harming a child, you will be responsible for your battle buddies getting ambushed. If anybody isn't able to do their duty and protect their battle buddies, stand up now and identify yourself." His words hung in the air, suspended by a growing feeling of dread. I wasn't sure I could run over a child to obey this direct order from my commander. I believed in sacrificing to serve my country, even taking a life to save a life. But this pricked at my conscience. I knew it wasn't an option to stand up and say, as the lone female soldier in the company, that I wouldn't put the lives of my battle buddies first and do my duty. It would be a betrayal. But getting up the next day and choosing to run over a child didn't feel possible either. Looking down at my sand-encrusted combat boots, I felt my heart pounding as I gripped the knobby seam of my dusty uniform pants. The tent was filled with a suffocating silence. No one moved. Before I could decide whether to stand up and identify myself or stay silent and do my duty, the first sergeant's voice boomed over my head like a firing cannon. "Dismissed." A wave of soldiers shuffled to their feet and poured out of the hot, dusty tent into the night air. The moment of decision was gone, and I exhaled a small breath of cowardly relief. But I still didn't know what I would do if a child were pushed in front of my convoy the next day. I had 8 hours to decide. 1. Boots on the ground. When you experience mercy, you learn things that are hard to learn otherwise. You see things you can't otherwise see. You hear things you can't otherwise hear. You begin to recognize the humanity that resides in each of us. Bryan Stevenson, Just Mercy. Burning air assaulted my lungs as I tumbled out of the C-130 transport plane into the ink-black desert night. The engines roared like pounding waterfalls, filling up my ears while the runway lights blinked and flashed around me. I sucked in a deep breath, pulling the syrupy thick air into my lungs, while the soles of my dust-colored combat boots turned sticky on the black-baked tarmac. The acrid tar smell of the heated runway singed my nose, draping itself like garland around the shoulders of the soldiers of Bravo Company. My company. 100 soldiers huddled together, waiting to face our first 30 seconds of war. We'd boarded the transport plane in the States, what felt like days or just minutes ago, and were now poured out into a war zone. Unable to see the landscape through the darkness, we stayed frozen in place. Sand-colored uniforms clumped together like human sandcastles piled on the runway, waiting for the next order. The dimming roar of the plane's engine echoed through the night air as it barreled down the runway away from us, turned the corner, and left us standing alone. "Medic!" the first sergeant yelled over top of the whine of the departing plane. "I want every soldier to have an antidote injector kit in their hands in the next 5 minutes. Saddam might attack us with poisonous gas. Keep your gas mask at the ready," barked the sergeant as he piled a mountain of green, wax-coated boxes of chemical antidote kits into my hands. The gas mask dangling at my hip would allow me to breathe during a chemical attack, filtering out the poison in the air, much as a charcoal filter cleans water. The antidote injectors act like a shot of adrenaline, helping the body fight off the poison's internal attack. But neither one would save you indefinitely. The sergeant's words scraped at the raw truth. Chemical warfare is a living horror show, and few survive it. The gas masks and antidote injectors equipped us with false bravado and borrowed time. When the air around you turns into a weapon, you can't outrun it. When your lungs turn into soggy pools of liquid, you can't breathe. The thought of drowning inside my own body without escape made my 23-year-old knees quiver. Pushing against the ticking clock and the fear of being attacked with poisonous gas, I ripped open the tops of the boxes holding the antidote kits, cardboard tearing the skin between my knuckles. My heart beat so loud in my ears that I couldn't hear anything else around me. In the darkness, I approached each huddled group of soldiers, and into the hands of every soldier, I shoved the required antidote kit to store with their gas mask. I had just 5 minutes to serve 100 soldiers needing medicine to keep them alive if the air around them turned into poison. "Breathe in, breathe out," I told myself. And just like that, I completed my first medic task to keep my soldiers alive in wartime. The invasion of Iraq had begun for my company. For a month before this moment, I had been training at Fort McCoy to be deployed in support of the global war on terror. I was taught to lie on my belly and use a 12-inch wooden stick to find hidden improvised explosive devices and disarm them before they harmed anyone. A skill every soldier learned before we deployed to the Iraq War. Nicknamed IEDs, these devices were different from the more sophisticated version called bombs. Medic was a nickname given to me, but I was a combat medic, trained to be on the field to save a life, trained to stop the bleeding and keep a soldier breathing and alive while I called in a helicopter or an ambulance to get them to a hospital. The medic backpack I carried held bandages and morphine to dull the pain, not the miracles and the reassurance my soldiers hoped for. If I could keep someone alive for the first 10 minutes following a battlefield injury, they cleared the first hurdle of survival. My knees shook under the weight of putting all my training into practice. I needed to keep my soldiers alive because their families and their kids expected them to return home. Their wives and families filled up my vision, as they had filled up the gym to send us off the previous week, until I couldn't see anything else. I couldn't feel anything else. Cold dread marched up my spine because I was standing in a killing zone. That's what war is. A battle to see who can kill more of the other until someone folds or surrenders. Turning to take one last look at the plane as I stepped off, I understood for the first time in a real, visceral way that I might never make it back home. Home was where I had picked up the phone 2 months earlier to the words that brought me here. After graduating college, I had started my first nursing job on the hospice oncology floor at St. Luke's Hospital. I lived with two roommates on the shore of Lake Superior and was pretty sure I'd met the man I wanted to marry. He hadn't called me since our first date, but I was an eternal optimist and had a feeling I couldn't shake about him. But on Valentine's Day, the day of the call, as I held the white plastic phone receiver up to the curve of my cheek, I heard the sergeant's voice crack like a whip. "Pack your bags and report for duty in 30 days. You are being deployed in support of the global war on terror." As I stood and listened, with the phone cord dangling loosely from all the times it had been stretched into three different bedrooms, I understood that I was going to war. The sergeant told me to write my will, move out of my apartment, and put my stuff in storage because he didn't know how long I would be gone or when I would return home. The sergeant didn't need to tell me where I was going. On TV, I had seen the bombs dropping in Iraq. The call meant the military wheels were already set in motion. The military works in reverse order. The commander-in-chief creates the mission and then calls up the soldiers and equipment needed to execute the mission. Calling up my unit to be deployed meant the commanding officers already knew exactly where we would be going and what mission my engineer battalion was needed for. Reporting for duty in 30 days was step one in a plan that had already been set. This is what we had trained for, but I never believed my Army National Guard unit would get called up for active duty overseas. We deployed to flood zones or to assist in recovery after a natural disaster, not to a war. Although I was a combat medic, I couldn't imagine putting into practice all the life-saving techniques I had learned to keep someone alive on the battlefield. I prayed I'd never have to use them. I had been in the National Guard almost 6 years since I signed up at 17 years old. My head understood what was happening, but my body wasn't catching up. I couldn't hold the weight of his words. They were like water dripping through my cupped hands. Their meaning was slipping through my grasp. It didn't feel possible to leave my life in Duluth, Minnesota, with my roommates, my church, and my family. The phone felt like it had turned into lead. 200 pounds of too much, too heavy to hold up. When I watched the Twin Towers fall on 9/11, sitting in nursing school, I knew the world was changing around me. Still, I didn't realize that 2 years later, my life would be changed by the terror of that day. My life now held a fault line, a before and an after, and I was standing at the edge. One phone call had cut me off from the life I knew and propelled me forward into a future I didn't want. After deplaning and getting our antidote kits, we waited on the tarmac in the desert night for the bus that would take us to a cluster of tents in the desert, where we were to sleep for the night. Eventually, it arrived, we boarded, and I slid into my seat as a small sigh of relief escaped underneath my breath. My first medic task was done. As the bus pulled away from the tarmac, the bus driver turned around and mumbled through the humid midnight air, "Don't peek through the closed curtains. You'll give the snipers an easy shot." 2. 8 hours. Sometimes the truth arrives on you and you can't get it off. That's when you realize that sometimes it isn't even an answer. It's a question. Even now, I wonder how much of my life is convinced. Marcus Zusak, The Book Thief. 8 hours wasn't long enough to decide if I could follow my orders to run over a child if necessary. The convoy briefing was over, but my night was just beginning. Walking back to my tent, I kept my head down, avoiding the other soldiers joking around me. The tension crackled as everyone geared up for driving into enemy territory the next day. The more dangerous the mission, the louder the jokes. That's how we handled fear. Rucksacks needed to be packed, gear double-checked, trucks fueled up before we rolled out at 4 o'clock the next morning. Inside the tent, I found my green cot, and underneath it, I lined up my medic bag, rucksack, flak vest, and 9mm Beretta, ready for tomorrow's mission. I lay down on top of my sleeping bag, trying to trick myself into sleeping. The commander's words were lodged in my brain. "You have to do your duty, even if it means running over a child." Everything I believed about being a soldier and a Christian reassured me this was okay. Soldiers did hard things. I knew that. That's why my Baptist church honored them and clapped for them. My mother and father stood up in the sanctuary on Veterans Day to be honored for their military service, and their father and brothers and cousins could stand up next to them, representing our family's commitment to enlisting. I was a third-generation Army veteran. My grandmother had sent three of her five children into basic training, and I was just one of her three grandchildren now on active duty. My family tree was like a human flagpole for the American flag. But something was crushing my chest in a vice grip, and it wouldn't let me sleep or even breathe. As I stared up into the darkness of the green camouflage tent, my cot felt as stiff and confining as a coffin. Arms folded across my chest, I lay motionless like a corpse. I struggled to shield myself from the indecision beating me up on the inside. How could I choose between the lives of my fellow soldiers and an Iraqi child? The impossibility of the choice was breaking me apart on the inside. Whose life would I protect, and whose would I take? Hoping no one would hear me, I whispered a tiny prayer, oh God, help me, into the dark. As I prayed for the tension in my chest to release, I heard something in the dark. But I love them. I love them too, Diana. I froze. The words halted the wrestling match inside me. Even though I know no words were actually spoken aloud, they seemed to echo all around me. This was not the first time I had felt sure I was sensing God, a divine presence that was so much bigger than me. The first time I experienced it, I was 10 years old at Trout Lake Bible Camp, where all the Minnesota Baptist churches sent their pale Scandinavian kids in the summer to swim, get sunburned, and accept salvation. I was clapping along in chapel when I felt like someone turned on a light switch in the room around me, and a phrase exploded in my mind like fireworks lighting up the 4th of July summer sky. God's love changes everything. My ears didn't hear the words exactly, but I felt warmth spread across my chest as I watched divine love change everything, repainting my thoughts and head and heart with vibrant colors. Love turned my black and white world into technicolor. Everything was different, as if noticing God everywhere ignited something that hadn't been there before. The words kept dancing around me. Everything is different because of my love. We each experience the divine in different ways, and I can't begin to explain the voice I heard that day at camp. But during my night in the Iraqi desert, I heard the same voice, and it turned my world upside down, just as it had done when I was 10 years old, clapping along in the chapel. The words cut through me, challenging everything I thought I knew. But I love them, Diana. I love them too. God was stepping into the middle of the darkened tent with me, but instead of comforting me, God was challenging me. But if God loved them, what did that mean for me and my orders? Was God challenging my loyalty to the us that I knew and loved? My uniform, my country, and my faith community had taught me that to serve my country is to serve God. I tried to understand. If God loved an Iraqi child the same sacrificial way God loved me, what was I supposed to do in 8 short hours if a child was pushed in front of the convoy? This was the first time I felt caught between what God was asking of me and what my country required of me. Wishing I was anywhere other than that tent in the middle of the desert, I squeezed my eyes tightly shut. I thought of the place where I grew up, a town of 8,000 people deep in the pine-dotted woods of northern Minnesota, famous only for walleye fishing, giant mosquitoes, and being the hometown of Judy Garland. I wished I could return to my no-place-like-home, just as she had. But instead, in Iraq, the yellow sunrise was coming, bringing an impossible choice. Tears slid down my face. The threads that stitched my beliefs together were fraying at the edges. I believed God is the greatest force of love the world has ever encountered, a self-sacrificing love that remakes and restores all that's broken and loves us back to life again. I knew God commands us to love our enemies, but now, in the middle of a war? I first learned about the sanctity of life not in the sanctuary of the church, but in a crowded meeting hall basement. My mom's friend brought a few of us fifth graders from church to a day-long rally. We were handed red shirts with pro-life printed across the front and garbage bags for the roadside trash cleanup we would be doing after lunch. I'd never seen adults behave this way. Wearing matching shirts, crowding together on metal folding chairs, drawing handmade signs, and listening to people shouting from a stage. God made life. Only God should decide when life begins and ends. The man at the microphone shouted as the room erupted in a level of noise that shocked me. Around me, I saw adults cheering and clapping, heads nodding up and down with uncharacteristic enthusiasm. After the program, we headed out to pick up trash along the highway while a gray rain misted us like potted plants. My jacket was shiny and slippery, while the wet seeped slowly into my esprit de corps sweatshirt underneath. We took a group photo under an Adopt-a-Highway sign on the side of the road with Minnesota Pro-Life stretched across the bottom in white block letters. I guess we cared most about protecting unborn life and the cleanliness of our city's roads. It was my first and last pro-life rally. But the words of the man at the microphone stuck with me as I grew up. Life did seem sacred. At least to my 10-year-old self, it seemed pretty simple. If I didn't make a life, I didn't have the authority to decide when it ended. If a life wasn't mine, then it wasn't mine to take. Sweating in the dark on my army-issued cot, I wrestled with God's words to me. My fingers traced the black plastic letters on my shirt spelling out Army across my chest. I knew my loyalty was to the name on my shirt, but the idea that life is sacred echoed in my ears as loud as it had that day from the stage, and I couldn't drown it out. The kingdom of heaven I was taught to pray for and build up didn't have violence, death, or killing. How could I pray a prayer asking for thy kingdom come, thy will be done, while readying myself to take a life? How could I be a citizen of heaven first while being a loyal citizen of my country? Which kingdom was I going to build up? All night I tried to reason with God. I have to. I have to take a life to save a life. Nevertheless, God's steady voice kept saying, "But I love them, Diana. I love them too." That's when I realized God loves my enemies as much as God loves me. God holds their future just as carefully as mine. And God was pleading with me to love my enemy the way God loves them. God was asking me to give my life away instead of taking a life. This choice would cost me. To say yes would require me to act in a way that would seem like betrayal to the people I loved the most, my country, my church, and even my family. It would cost me my sense of belonging in the only places that felt like home. My knee-jerk response was, "No, what will people think? I can't." I told God it would cost me too much. I wrestled with being rejected by the people and army and country that I held in such high esteem, much higher esteem than the lives of my so-called enemies, who were also created and beloved by God. My self-preservation called out, "But what about me, God? What about my life? What about my security, my safety, My being accepted and esteemed. Quietly and patiently, God asked me for my allegiance, for my right to violence, the very key that granted me.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?